This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, we'll speak with an activist with the Indian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel about their ongoing and expanding activism against Israel's human rights violations.
A lot of these new links with Israel are talking about privatization, increased security, surveillance, military ties. So it is actually a complete shift in the way India views itself.
Also, a report on how the Israeli siege leaves 80% of Gaza's factories shut. And in the West Bank, a rooftop garden project aims to reduce Palestinian refugees' dependence on aid. Palestinians fleeing Syria denied help in Lebanon. Every minute matters for gravely ill hunger striker Samer El-Bark, according to his family. The U.S. is sued over terrorist designation that has robbed a Palestinian American of basic rights for 17 years. Scholars voice opposition to a California Assembly resolution that seeks to chill Palestine solidarity activism and free speech. And news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement as the European Union considers a ban on trade with Israeli settlements. A South African university's student council unanimously adopts a resolution for the full academic and cultural boycott of Israel, and more. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. Coming up later in this broadcast, an exclusive interview with an activist with the Indian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. But first, these top stories. We begin in the Gaza Strip. Eva Bartlett wrote in a story for Interpress Service and published in the Electronic Intifada this week that 80% of factories in Gaza are still closed or operating at minimum capacity due to Israel's ongoing siege and blockade, which began in 2006, following the electoral victory of the Hamas political party. Bartlett writes about a factory owner whose company was one of 97% of industrial establishments in Gaza, which had stopped production by 2008 as a result of Israel's closure of Gaza's boundaries that limited imports and, quote, virtually halted all exports. By December 2007, Bartlett adds, the United Nations had already reported that only 1% of Gaza's 960 garment factories remained open. Bartlett's report adds that, quote, focusing on Gaza's devastated economy, the UN noted in June that the continued ban on the transfer of goods from Gaza to its traditional markets in the West Bank and Israel, along with the severe restrictions on access to agricultural land and fishing waters, prevents sustainable growth and perpetuates the high levels of unemployment, food insecurity, and aid dependency, end quote. Meanwhile, Bartlett adds, quote, the Israeli human rights group Gisha has cited estimates that 85% of Gaza's exports traditionally went to Israeli and Palestinian markets outside of Gaza. Gisha has also noted that any claims of security precautions being the reason for prohibiting exports from Gaza held no weight, end quote. Gaza's unemployment rates continue to hover between 35 and 65%, and food aid dependency remains at 80%, Bartlett added in her report. That was an excerpt of a report by Eva Bartlett, reporting from the Gaza Strip. For more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. In another report from Interpress Service, Gillian Kessler-Damour reported from the West Bank that Palestinian residents of the Dehesha refugee camp near Bethlehem have initiated a project to establish and maintain rooftop greenhouses and gardens as a means to help empower women in meeting their families' nutritional needs. Dehesha refugee camp, which was established following the forced displacement of Palestinians from their Jerusalem area villages in 1948, has approximately 13,000 residents living on less than half a square kilometer. Organizers of the Garden Project told Interpress Service that it is intended as an example for how Palestinian refugees can become less dependent on international donations. In her report, Kessler-Damour writes, quote, the camp suffers from a myriad of problems, including overcrowding, poor infrastructure, and a lack of schools. One-third of camp residents are unemployed, and 15% of homes are not connected to the public sewer system. Food insecurity levels improved overall by 7% from 2010 to 2011 in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, according to data collected by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. But the situation worsened for Palestinians living in the West Bank refugee camps, where food insecurity rates registered at 29% in 2011. That was an excerpt of a full report on this issue by Gillian Kessler-Damour. For much more on the story, visit electronicintifada.net. Writing from Beirut, Lebanon, our correspondent Mo Ali Nayel reported this week that Palestinian refugees fleeing the violence in Syria are being denied help in Lebanon. Nayel writes, quote, according to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, there are more than 470,000 Palestinian refugees in Syria. Palestinian refugees fled to Syria after they were pushed out of their homeland in 1948 during the establishment of the State of Israel. He adds, quote, denied their right of return, Palestinians have held refugee status for nearly 65 years. Palestinian camps in Syria were still considered a safe haven until 3 months ago when they began to be affected by the clashes between Bashar al-Assad's regime and rebel fighters. The UN refugee agency UNHCR recently published estimates that 43,760 Syrian refugees have taken shelter in Lebanon since last year. The Lebanese government has a flexible entry policy for Syrians seeking refuge in Lebanon. A Syrian refugee is allowed to enter Lebanon without entry fees and can stay for a period of 6 months or longer, subject to renewal. However, in his report, Mo Ali Nayel says that the entry situation changes when a Palestinian refugee is fleeing the same precarious circumstances and areas as Syrian nationals. He reports that Palestinian refugees fleeing to Lebanon from Syria are only permitted entry for 1 week and are required to renew their permits after that, which can be prohibitively expensive for families, especially in Lebanon, where Palestinians have been banned from dozens of types of jobs. Nayel writes, quote, with the appalling situation in Syria, Palestinians are caught in the crossfire and forced into displacement yet again. For much more on this developing story by Mo Ali Nayel, including interviews with Palestinian refugees and UN agency officials, visit electronicintifada.net. The hunger strikes inside Israeli jails continue. As our correspondent Shahid Abu Salama wrote this week on her blog on the Electronic Intifada, four imprisoned Palestinians who are protesting their ongoing administrative detention, indefinite imprisonment without charge or trial, remain on hunger strike. This week, Abu Salama reported that one of the hunger strikers, Samer al-Bark, has been on hunger strike for more than 110 days after the Israeli prison service renewed his detention orders, reneging on their agreement signed in mid-May to release him. Al-Bark was on hunger strike until the agreement was signed, and then once the Israeli prison service reneged on the deal, he resumed his hunger strike. Abu Salama added that the details of al-Bark's detention are unclear. She wrote, quote, what is known is that Samer has been subjected to arrest and detention by multiple countries without charge or trial. Amnesty International reports that according to Samer's brother, Samir Helmi al-Bark, Samer was, quote, arrested by the Pakistani authorities on July 15, 2003, and held for 14 days after applying to study for a PhD in Islamic studies in Islamabad. Amnesty adds, quote, he was then handed over to the U.S. authorities and kept for an additional 3 months in a secret prison in an unknown location outside Pakistan. He alleged in a private statement received by Amnesty International that he suffered numerous forms of inhumane torture during that period. Al-Bark said he was handed over to the Jordanian authorities in October 2003, who kept him in detention for over 4 years without charging him or telling him why he was being held. For more on this story, including Shahid Abu Salama's interviews with Al-Bark's parents in the West Bank, visit her blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. This week, the Electronic Intifada's Maureen Murphy reported that, quote, a lawsuit has been filed challenging the constitutionality of the so-called terrorist designation of Palestinian-American citizen Mohamed Salah and the unprecedented restrictions that come with it. In her report, Murphy writes that the complaint filed last Wednesday by attorneys from the Center for Constitutional Rights, the People's Law Office, and a private firm, quote, contends that Salah's fundamental rights are violated by the designation. The U.S. Department of Treasury's 1995 classification of Salah as a specially designated terrorist bars, quote, virtually all economic transactions, even those necessary for survival, according to a press release issued on Wednesday, end quote. Murphy adds, quote, there is no expiry for the terrorist designation or any mechanism to challenge its imposition through the courts. Salah is believed to be the only U.S. citizen classified as such residing in the U.S. The civil complaint filed by the attorneys states that Salah has lived under these unprecedented conditions for more than 17 years, with no end in sight. No other U.S. citizen must seek such specific advance approval from the government for his every transaction. The following is a full excerpt from Maureen Murphy's post. The executive order designating Salah a specially designated terrorist, signed by then-President Bill Clinton, was, quote, designed to target groups and individuals considered to be interfering with the Middle East peace process, the press release explains. As stated in the civil complaint filed last week, the executive order designation and its associated restrictions were imposed on Salah without due process, quote, without a criminal or civil trial, administrative hearing, or even notice and an opportunity to respond. The criminal complaint reveals how the designation restrictions are so sweeping that compliance with them is virtually impossible. They prohibit Salah, who currently suffers from cancer, from leading anything close to a normal life. The detailed description of what the restrictions mean for Salah's daily life make it clear that the terrorist designation is a de facto prison sentence without charge or trial. That was an excerpt of a post by Maureen Murphy. For much more on the story, visit Maureen's blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. In response to the California Assembly's recent passage of a resolution calling on university administrations to address what it calls anti-Semitism on California campuses, a group of academics have written an open letter of opposition to each of the 66 Assembly members who authored and/or sponsored the resolution. On my blog this week, I wrote that the non-binding resolution, H.R. 35, which was adopted without debate on August 28th, contains language which civil rights groups, activists, students, and professors see as a thinly disguised scheme to limit Palestine solidarity activism and curb discussion of Israeli policies in the classroom. Zionist organizations and Israel lobby groups have been relentlessly attempting to repress free speech and Palestine activism on campuses across the U.S., trying to stifle debate and discussion about Israeli policies by claiming that such speech is, quote, anti-Semitic. In their open letter, California Scholars for Academic Freedom say that, quote, the resolution poses a clear threat to academic freedom in the University of California and the California State University systems. H.R. 35 does not create new law, but it calls upon university administrations to deny First Amendment rights to students and faculty. For much more on this story, visit my blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. This week, our correspondent Michael Deese, European coordinator of the Palestinian BDS National Committee, reported that, quote, comments by a Greek diplomat and the Norwegian foreign minister suggest that European governments are discussing taking action against settlement produce. Deese adds that, quote, Israeli media reports are claiming that a Greek diplomat told reporters that the EU is considering a ban on importing settlement produce. Meanwhile, Norway's foreign minister hinted that his country, which is not part of the EU, is also considering taking action against trade in settlement goods, according to Israeli daily Haaretz. Deese also said that, quote, these latest comments from European officials follow recent decisions by the Danish and South African governments to join the UK in issuing guidance that settlement products should be labeled in a way that distinguishes them from other Israeli exports. The Irish foreign minister has stated that Ireland supports an EU ban on settlement trade. In May, a UK foreign minister appeared to hint that the UK government is considering further action on settlement products. Campaigners from several other European countries have reported that foreign ministries have become much more open to calls for action on settlement products in recent months. This gradual but significant change in attitude by major governments should be viewed as a response, at least partially, to successful campaigning by the Movement for Boycotts, Divestment, and Sanctions against Israel. That was an excerpt of a longer report by Michael Deese for our BDS blog on the Electronic Intifada. You can find it at electronicintifada.net/blogs. In other news, the Palestinian BDS National Committee released a statement condemning the normalization activities of Palestinian-American tycoon Bashar Masri, whom it accused of advancing, quote, personal interests and profit-making at the expense of Palestinian rights. The Electronic Intifada reported that Masri is renowned as the developer of Rawabi, a Qatari-financed luxury housing development built on West Bank land, confiscated from three Palestinian villages by the Palestinian Authority and handed over to Masri's private firm. The Electronic Intifada has previously reported on some of Masri's activities in relation to Rawabi. Meanwhile, the Electronic Intifada reported that activists in Seoul are condemning the use of South Korean-made equipment used to demolish Palestinian homes and property in the occupied West Bank. A new report released by the Palestine Peace Solidarity at Seoul calls on the South Korean government to, quote, enforce an immediate ban on all products or services related to the settlements, Israel's wall in the West Bank, or occupation, and to cease government trade, research, or investment promotion activities with Israel, and to freeze agreements in trade, investment, or military matters. In addition, PPS calls on the South Korean business and academic community to halt immediately any dealings with companies and institutions related to the settlements, apartheid wall, or occupation. In a September 7th press release, Palestine Peace Solidarity at Seoul writes that the ties between South Korea and Israel have contributed to Israel's impunity and lack of accountability. This week, the Student Council at Witwatersrand, or Wits University in Johannesburg, South Africa, unanimously adopted a full academic and cultural boycott of Israel on August 29th. The Wits Student Council's resolution says that it will, quote, not participate in any form of cultural or academic collaboration or joint projects with Israeli institutions and will not provide support to Israeli cultural or academic institutions. The boycott resolution, quote, also calls for an immediate investigation into any relationships that Wits University, which is based in Johannesburg, may have with any Israeli institutions, including academic, financial, and cultural relations. And finally, in India, human rights activists in Hyderabad gathered to protest the participation of three Israeli universities in the Indo-Global Education Summit. According to a press release on the Indian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel's website, the demonstrators went to the summit venue protesting collaboration efforts of the Indian government with the Israeli government. Joining us to talk about the growing BDS movement in India is Geeta Hariharan of Inkakbi. She joins us from Delhi. Geeta, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
My pleasure.
So let's talk about the Indian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, or Inkakbi, and some of the BDS campaigns you've been a part of in the past months. Tell us about Inkakbi and why so many Indian activists, writers such as yourself, scholars, artists, and workers have joined the Palestinian-led BDS movement.
Well, when we began in 2010 in response to the Palestinian call, we didn't realize that there would be such a wide variety of people who'd be interested. Now, that is not to say there aren't tremendous problems, but briefly let me say that all our campaigns, appeals, and our recent demonstration in Hyderabad have shown that a range of people have been coming together, students, academics, even engineers working in the software industry joined the demonstration in Hyderabad, which I hope we will speak about. What is happening, Nora, is that on the one hand, there is a tremendous response to the call for solidarity with Palestine. On the other hand, this is also a response to the shift in India's foreign policy, the strategic shift from the support for Palestine, which existed during the freedom struggle in India, to the not only business as usual with Israel today in India, but business more than usual.
Well, Geeta, talk about the protest this past week in Hyderabad against Israel's participation in the Global Education Summit. And of course, this came just weeks after Inkakbi put out a major statement in opposition to the India-Israel Free Trade Agreement. So if you can tell us about the current relationship a little bit more between Israel and India and how activists are working to address these partnerships.
The Indo-Global Education Summit and Expo 2012 in Hyderabad, which was held from September 7th to 9th this year, is a typical example. We found out quite accidentally that this was being held and that though it's not organized by the government, it is organized by something called the Indus Foundation. But the government has, in a way, given its imprimatur, because the preface, the introduction to their official pamphlet is, in fact, signed by a union minister of the Indian government. So rallying around this, again, demonstrated the need not only to express solidarity with Palestine by saying, why have you got these Israeli academic institutions here, particularly Technion with its deep military ties with the Israeli establishment, but also the fact that the summit itself is doing something to Indian education in general. You know, there, a lot of these new links with Israel are talking about privatization, increased security, surveillance, military ties. So it is actually a complete shift in the way India views itself. So it the combination that we had of people who came to this wonderful demonstration, which I simply must describe, this is this summit was being held at a five-star hotel called the Taj Deccan in Hyderabad. And the various groups that came together on September 3rd, and they announced the protest for the 7th at a roundtable conference on September 3rd. And the police apparently refused permission for a demonstration. And when the group said, well, we're going to hold it anyway, and the police did give permission, and apparently at 11:30 in the morning outside the Taj Deccan, you had students, you had academics, as I said, you had these engineers, you had a group called Awaz, which is working with the minorities, another group, an NGO called Kova, which works primarily with Muslims, but you had a combination of political affiliations, you know, different communities and so on. And apparently, when they arrived there, the police stopped the demonstration. And in effect, the demonstration was a series of scuffles and arrests. And of course, there was very poor media coverage. So, which gives you an idea of what we are up against when you demonstrate, you know, anti-Israel and pro-Palestine. One is that the mainstream media will not give you the attention you deserve. On the other hand, the police, naturally, this is a high-profile thing in a five-star hotel, and so they are going to be very difficult about what you're allowed to do. But the fact that they came together, and when the organizers of the demonstration spoke to me, they said, you know, it really was a first, and we want to do more. We want people to come to Hyderabad and talk about the situation in Palestine and talk about the new relationship that India has with Israel.
That's the voice of Geeta Hariharan speaking to us from Delhi. She's part of the Indian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. And Geeta, along the same realm, NCACBI has initiated a call for the academic boycott of Israeli universities across India. Can you talk a little bit more about how this campaign has developed?
Well, one of the problems is that there are so many MOUs, as we call them, memorandums of understanding, with Israeli institutions being signed all over the place. We can hardly keep up. So we find that we are issuing several statements a week, because almost every day we find that there's been a new MOU signed. For example, we discovered that in Ahmedabad, which is in Gujarat state, there is an institution which has been set up called iCreate, which has a link with Technion. And in fact, they have somebody from Technion, a faculty member, on their advisory board. So that is one, for example. Then there is actually an academic research agreement between the University Grants Commission, which is a very important body in India, with the Israel Science Foundation. So this is the sort of, you know, these are the things we have found out about, but we don't even know how many links and MOUs there are that we don't even know about. So what we are trying to do is write to as many academics as we can. We are using our site. We are using our Facebook page. And so the first thing is to disseminate information. We're also hoping to have a university event on November 29th to show solidarity with Palestine, to actually get students and academics, faculty in certain universities and colleges in different parts of India to use a kit we send them and create their own event to discuss not only what is happening with India's growing relationship with Israel, but what is happening in Palestine, and to actually discuss what do we mean when we say Israel is an apartheid state, and why are we talking about a boycott, because there's a lot of confusion about the boycott, so we need to discuss that.
Well, let's explore the recent campaigns in the cultural boycott vein. Last year around this time, an extensive list of prominent Indian artists boycotted invitations to show their work at the Tel Aviv Museum. And several months ago, the tabla maestro Zakir Hussain canceled his scheduled performance in Israel due to the efforts of BDS activists in India and around the world. Talk about some of these campaigns and why these cultural boycotts are so significant.
I think, finally, artists know deep in their hearts, you know, artists and writers know that you cannot, if you are an artist of conscience, you know, you don't write and perform and paint in a vacuum. And I think we're terribly proud of these artists who have responded, who have shown that, you know, there is life beyond a career and a good concert or a good art exhibit. So we are very proud of them. And of course, when somebody like Zakir Hussain cancels a performance, people sit up and say, well, you know, let me learn more about this. And similarly, the artists boycotting, one of our artists called Pushpa Malla did a wonderful job. She spoke to any number of artists. There was debate, which I think is what is important, because it's only when there's debate that people are going to start asking sharp questions about why are we sitting here in India and, you know, why are we working so hard for Palestine. So a whole plethora of issues then come up, that it is Palestine, what is the what is life under occupation like? At the same time, how do we pressurize the Indian government to bridge the gap between the kind of rhetorical support they occasionally offer for Palestine? On the other hand, they see themselves as very much with Israel in their new self-image. So this is what we are hoping to do, and we do hope that we can work towards an exchange of students, artists, academics. At one time, when I was a young woman, we saw a lot of Palestinian students in India, and that's really not true anymore. There's been a significant drop. And one of the things in CACBI would like to do is make sure that we have we pressurize the government. At the same time, we ask for help from other organizations to actually make sure that we can bring Palestinian artists and academics and students here, and perhaps we could go there as well.
That's Geeta Hariharan from the Indian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. Geeta, tell our listeners how they can follow the work of NCACBI and learn more about the campaigns.
Our website is www.incacbi.org. INCACBI, that is INCACBI.in. We also have a very lively Facebook page, which you can find. You know, the net is there. It's the easiest thing in the world to find. Our email address is incacbi@gmail.com, and we'd be delighted to hear from anyone who can give us suggestions, information, and simply express solidarity.
Geeta, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you.
For more on this story and other important news from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, go to electronicintifada.net/tags/BDS. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out our insightful book reviews and activism news, including a contribution from an activist convicted of trespassing a weapons factory, who vows to keep exposing the illegal arms trade with Israel, an op-ed on why development aid projects in Palestine are doomed to fail, and an analysis on whether a Green Party presidential candidate would end military aid to Israel, and much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.